very warm welcome to you, Dr. David Abram, here on the Nordic Animism channel. I'm super excited to be able to have this this chat with you. Dr. Abram is a cultural ecologist, philosopher, and author of books like The Spell of the Sensuous and Becoming Animal. He has had played an important role in the process of animism becoming a position that is now available for many people to think from and work with. So welcome on the channel here.
It's great to be here, man.
Great.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about your history with animism and in particular, and how you got into that, or how you have worked with that?
Well, okay. Let's just say first that I'm a cultural ecologist. Sort of combining elements of anthropology and ecology, looking at what we can learn from other cultures about what might be better to do vis-a-vis the whole more than human landscape that enfolds our communities. What maybe we ought not to do? Can we learn from the mistakes of other cultures? And can they learn from our egregious mistakes? A cultural ecologist and a philosopher, or what some folks started calling me, a geophilosopher, and I've kind of taken a shine to that. Geophilosophy, that is, someone who is working out the ways of thinking under the influence of the more than human earth. My particular fascinations are with the ecology of perception, or what we could call the ecology of sensory experience, the way the activity of our animal senses, of our eyes, of our ears, of our skin, functions to bind our separate nervous systems into the encompassing ecosystem, wherever we find ourselves, as if perception itself was like a glue that, yes, entangles and binds our individual organism into the wider life of the living land itself. But I'm also just as interested in what we could call the ecology of language, how what we say so profoundly influences what we see or what we hear or even taste of the earth around us. Because I'm convinced that that there are ways of speaking that many of us have inherited from the goofy civilization into which we've been educated, ways of speaking that actually work to frustrate and stifle that instinctive sensorial rapport between our animal senses and the sensuous earth around us. But I'm just as convinced that there exist other ways of speaking, other ways of wielding our words that actually can encourage and enhance that spontaneous reciprocity between our breathing body and the living flesh of
awesome.
The earth.
Yeah, I share your conviction in both those matters. I think our language is deeply affects our perception. A good friend of mine has Inuit background and studied Inuit language. He didn't have it from his childhood, but he studied it, and it's very difficult. So he has explained to me how during colonization, specific grammatical forms that in Inuit itself expresses degree of potentiality become reinterpreted, and they become a future tense, for instance. So something that can, so you see there's an epistemological shift in the inside the grammar in the cultural encounter. And I think that probably generalizes in many ways in language. And you can probably find similar processes in many ways. And this, by the way, was also this was part of my initial interest in talking to you, because I had been asking myself this question: why is it that many people have this intuition that old language somehow carries more animacy in it than newer language? Because that seems to me to be a deeper thing than just, you know, a general, perhaps, Judeo-Christian fetish for very old stuff, which is certainly there, but there seems to be more in it than that. And then I had kind of concocted some idea about how the history of linguistics, that the loss of conjugation made language less relational. I showed it to some linguist friend of mine, and they were like, yeah, perhaps you got something there, but perhaps you should talk to Abram about this. So let me try to pitch that question to you. What old language, have you any thoughts about that particular idea, that old language seems to speak with a greater animacy to some people?
Well, sure. Old language, it's curious what you're calling old language. I would say all of our languages derive from old roots and upwellings from the depths. But all languages, that is, derive from old oral origins. Human language starts percolating long before there are any formal systems of writing, and certainly long before there's a formalized scripts that are coupled to the spoken language, such as you and I now take for granted. Writing is a pretty recent modality, unless you take it in the broadest sense and recognize that when you're out tracking bear, tracking elk through the forest, tracking snowshoe hares through the snow, as I was doing up here in the mountains. I should say I'm speaking from the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, the southernmost spur of the Rocky Mountain spine of the North American continent. So I'm here just on the western slope of that southernmost end of the Rockies, gazing out across the high desert valley toward the Jemez Mountains, across the way. This is the upper Rio Grande Valley, which is dotted here and there by pueblos. This is the land of the Tewa and Tiwa and Towa speaking Pueblo cultures, of which there are many, speaking actually five different languages derived from five radically different sources, and yet all sharing a rich and fairly common cosmology. It's a pretty scrumptious place to gaze out at today. The sky is clear as a bell. No, there's a few clouds just blowing in from the southwest. It seems to me that that old languages are just more and more deeply oral, have not yet been so affected by the context written pages, written papyrus, scrolls, written books, and certainly not infected hardly at all by the screen, the dazzle of the digital screen. Writing brings a wild torsion in our experience of language and linguistic meaning. And there are so many ways to get at that, but let's just acknowledge that first, that oral language, and hence human language, verbal language, originates in a kind of call and response all the time. But since every deeply oral culture, that is to say, every deeply indigenous place-based culture we know of today was traditionally richly animistic, that is to say, assumed from the get-go that everything was alive or potentially alive, animate, filled with dynamism, each thing its own rhythm, each thing its own pulse, its own way of radiating out of itself into the world to affect the things around it. Well, these were all animistic cultures, each in their own curious way. But such cultures don't just hold that everything is alive, but that everything speaks. That not just humans, but of course, owls hooting off at dusk, the rhythm of the crickets itself is heard as a kind of expression, the splashing speech of waves on the beach, the wind in the willows, that too is a kind of voice, the howling of wolves, of course, bird song, squawking of ravens. Everything potentially speaks.
Mm.
Everything is expressive. So our language, originating in these old cultures, is born in a kind of call and response to a speaking world. It's not just born in between humans talking to one another. It's born between us, between our sounding body and the bodies of these trees and the body of those storm clouds, which every now and then utter forth that rum, tumble, rumble, thickening drum we call thunder, which one could call like the first big word. So
the ye or.
Yeah. So I would say that human language is massively infected in its depths by the voices of other beings.
Yeah.
Other sounding presences. And this is so deeply true at the deep origin of our languages when living in such ancestral contexts, we had to, there's no guns. So with simple spears or knives, we nonetheless have to bag another animal to get dinner. To get close enough to another creature to be successful in the hunt, you needed to apprentice yourself richly and deeply to the ways of these other organisms. And one element of that included learning their calls and learning their so that they wouldn't think you a total alien or stranger if you could make cries that are common to those that they make among themselves. And so among hunting and foraging peoples, one finds the rich calls and cries of birds and of other animals, of prey animals, is right there entering into and affecting the human discourse, playing a part in that whole interconnected web of human language, right?
Totally. Totally. And it seems to me that a couple of the animals that you mentioned here, birds, you mentioned the owl, for instance, and you mentioned the wolf, their names, even in contemporary English or other North European language, are actually onomatopoeia. They sound like the word owl, sound like an imitation of the sound of that animal, right? And isn't there something about that, then that word is less of an abstraction? There is an immanence in that way that word is connected to that organism. You know, it's not in Saussure's distinction between the signifier and the signified. It's do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, very much so, very much so. There's an imminent echo,
yeah,
in the language itself, in our words themselves, of many powers afoot in the living landscape. We could speak of you know, just even the words today that we use in English to describe the movement of the stream, the water in a stream, between the banks of the stream. We'll use words like rush, gush, wash, splash. But the sound that unites all those words, rush, gush, wash, splash, is the sound that the stream itself speaks as it's moving through the banks between the two sides of the river. It's rushing along there. That is to say, our language is fed and has always been fed by the speech of many beings that are not human. And it's so important that we recognize this, that human language itself is born in a call and response with a speaking, animate, expressive world, landscape. And, you know, and that being said, I'll just mention that this onomatopoeic quality that you refer to, Rune, it's so often operative, but subtly so. It's not as overt and obvious as people sometimes want it to be. That is, it works sometimes in a very subtle register. For instance, when I blink my eyes like I'm doing just now, it doesn't make any sound at all, really. But if it did make a sound, the sound it would make would probably be something like blink, blink. It has that watery quality, and yet then the liquid consonant blink moves back as the eye opens again. Echoing quality can sometimes be very, very subtle.
I think it's a very beautiful point you're making, that human language is born in this call and response. It's almost like a song metaphor that you're using with basically the speaking world, and that it's still there, as if there is a node in it. If we think about the idea of distinguishing language from the world and abstracting it, and saying there are signifiers and then there's some unnamed material other, then how do we move back into that immanentist way of using language?
Yeah, how do we begin to bring something of this back into our speaking. I think there are so many ways to approach this. Some of them that are the most potent and powerful, I think I want to leave till later in the conversation, because I think it's key to pay attention to how we could have got so estranged from this way of speaking so much that we now think language, or at least human language, verbal language, is a way of representing the world from outside, as if language were a virus from outer space. That's actually a line from William Burroughs. Language is a virus from outer space that gets at the world from outside and maps it, you know, and makes a representation of each thing. But it's not. Language bubbles up in the midst of the world, just like the brook bubbles up from a spring deep in the woods. Things sound all the time. And far from being a tool first to represent the world as if we were outside it, looking at it from a kind of God's eye attached position. Old languages, oral cultures generally, use language not to represent the world or to represent, to talk about that mountain over there, or to talk about the weather, or to talk about that stand of trees. No, they're just as much using language to talk to the mountain, to call the sun up out of the ground in the morning, as many folks in the Pueblos here do every dawn, to speak to the moon, to conjure clouds out of the fathomless blue so that they can gather and get heavy with rain and drop it upon the high desert here. That is, language is a way of calling oneself into the presence of the forest, of calling oneself into the presence of that mountain, or of calling that mountain into relation with me, and then listening for its reply. Language is a way of bridging the distance, the gap between oneself and another, much like when we use it to say to a friend or to a sweetheart, "I love you." You know, that's language in that most Aboriginal sense, touching the world and making it vibrate and listening for what the world itself has to say.
Manifesting relation with a some, the world as a someone, perhaps. Yes.
Not just manifesting, but enacting relation. Enacting relation. It's to speak is to do something. But the whole notion that words are, you know, represent the things that they name, this only becomes possible with writing, with writing it down. Like I write down the word tree or pine, and I now have a visible set of marks on a page that I can put next to that pine tree. And so it's like a label that fits on the pine tree. And I write oak, and here's a label for the oak. That is, there's the actual visible, palpable oak. And now there's this other visible reality that stays in existence, O-A-K, on the page, that can now function as a label for that first rooted, upright presence. So the very possibility of thinking of verbal language as a set of representations that double the world. You know, they make a map of the world, or they provide a full representation of the world, only comes with writing. Before you're able to write it down on any stable surface, the world that you encounter an oak tree, and it just, you know, sometimes startles you, like some of the big ponderosas around here, and a voice, you know, stutters out of your mouth, and sometimes that's the name of that tree, or so, the sandhill cranes as they're flying south for the winter overhead, and they have these croaking cries as they circle and spiral overhead and then continue on their way. And and it's so body shattering, these cries, that you just feel them reverberating all through you when there's a lot of them, especially. And it leaves this trace in your musculature, and you find yourself trying to make that same cry. Raven does this too. Around here, we've got lots of big ravens, and you often come upon someone out in the woods who thinks they're alone with no other humans around, and they're just there squawking away, trying to coax the raven to come closer. And some of them are damn good at it, as is my son. I used to have a kick-in raven call, but then I lost, in the last 10 years, I lost my whole upper register of my voice. So my raven calls, the ravens just sort of like ignore it. It's very...
Our common friend there, Professor Haukeland from Norway, he mentioned that he had met an old man, an old Sami man in northern Norway, who were actually able to communicate with wild ravens, so they would help him find moose when he went moose hunting. A quite astonishing case of interspecies communication there.
Oh yes, here in Alaska, I've been out hunting with a wonderful hunter named Richard Nelson, wonderful wilderness writer as well. And Nels took me out to this island to hunt, and we tracked for a while. And then there were just a few ravens soaring overhead, and he looked up at them and he said, "Now watch them close, because they know we're here. And if one of them starts to tumble," and just then one of them did like a somersault, he said, "Okay, they're letting us know where the wolves are. No, they're letting us know where the deer is. We're tracking deer. And so just follow them." And so we went following the ravens, and when they would get too far ahead, they'd circle back and just, and till we could see them again, and then led us to this place in the woods where indeed the deer were, because there's a pact, as Richard Nelson explained to me, between hunters and the ravens that is also found between wolves and ravens. So ravens also lead wolf packs to the deer, to the kill. Mm. And the wolves very carefully, after they make the kill, leave various innards of the deer for the ravens to then eat.
Wow. And wow. You experienced that. Hunter, yeah.
So the human hunters have picked this up from the wolves there in Alaska, and do the same thing. I'll just say Richard Nelson was deeply tutored by the hunters of the Northern Forest, and particularly the Koyukon people of Central Alaska, who were his primary teachers in these ways.
Okay. Wow. So turning back to language, writing, it seems that, like you're saying, that writing is sort of the original post-it system where labeling, and thereby abstraction and representation detaches language from its imminent unity with the world, basically.
Yes, so although can we qualify this a tiny bit by just saying that when we're out tracking deer or bear or wolf or mountain lion, and you're following their tracks through the snow or through the leaf litter in the forest, that too is a kind of writing. In fact, I'm convinced that our ability to read, including to read, you know, texts in books like, you know, this one, comes from an organ, a synesthetic organ that was developed and honed by our hunting ancestors. You know, tracking the deer across the field, and whenever the track leaves off, you have to find where it picks up again. It's like you get to the end of the these tracks, like on a page. It's not that different from deer tracks in the snow, and you get to the end of the line and you have to pick up the line where it starts afresh. Oh, here it is. That is, reading is a form of tracking.
Yeah,
it's following traces, tracks.
Yeah.
And it's a deep, old, ancestral, deeply animistic practice. But it was kind of a new and audacious thing for us to start tracking ourselves and making our own tracks and then tracking them as a way to leave messages for one another. So there's no hard and fast point where reading and writing begins, because tracking itself is the oldest of the oldest human skills and pre-human skills that there is.
It also seems to me that if you look at early writing culture, then there is immediately these, as you say, very strongly animist ways of understanding it, like the Latin alphabet that we have. I think a myth says that Hermes created it actually from the flights of cranes. So these V shapes that cranes fly in, they actually inspired Hermes to produce the letters that we're still using today. And like if you look at the Nordic tradition, the runes are, they're actually trees, or they're conceptualized as trees to some extent. So they grow up from the underground, and Odin goes into the roots of the interconnected cosmos to find them somehow. And obviously the Jewish tradition has perhaps the most developed idea of mystic understanding of letters of all. And so there's something about writing that seems that people also want to make it into a vehicle of animacy somehow.
I wonder if that isn't partly a result of how old and deep in us was this propensity for tracking, the necessity to be learning the tracks and traces of other animals in order to acquire the food for your village, for your camp. That is to say, there's something so viscerally fascinating about the hunt, where you're tracking this other being who sometimes, if you're successful, you meet and you encounter the other. And there's, and sometimes there's a kill. Or if you're really unlucky, the kill goes the other way and it's you who are killed. But the power in that, I think, is still a power that animates us whenever we're reading a good book. You're tracking the meaning and tracking it, getting closer to it, farther from it, but always tracking this meeting, this meaning, which will be the meeting with the other. That in some sense, if this is right, the fascination that holds us to a good book is really a fascination with the mystery, the otherness, nature itself, still calling to us through the traces, through the tracks.
Yeah. And I wonder if there's even a link with a kill, because what is a kill? It's an objectification. Or the hunter's kill is a life-giving objectification. So, and does language objectify somehow in the writing form, perhaps? I don't know, is there in a similar way, a fruitful, I don't know, maybe it's to...
I think there may well be interesting analogies to draw out there. Ponder that. I want to hear back from you on that. But I think there is this sense that there's an author behind here, but one rarely gets to know just what the author really intends, really. But you have these moments of like, I got it. Or sometimes I'm reading philosophy and it's like so opaque. And then, I get it. And you feel like you come face to face with this other. And sometimes you become friends with an author who you've read over and again, and it's just been so fascinating. And then blessed be, you actually get to meet her. It's like, wow, hey, that's who you are. But hopefully not an objectification.
I remember, well, maybe it's a mutual objectification and then it's even better. I don't know. I remember reading, I think, I forgot the source of it, but it was a medieval monk describing the experience of reading. And that was a very sensuous, actually, experience of light and revelation and all kinds of in the interaction with letters. So it's funny how language, when it becomes writing, has a problematic potential, or it starts manifesting this rupture, or what Graham Harvey calls the separatist agenda, but that it also has this incredible it also has animacy somehow, but
let me speak to that a moment, Rune. It's very apropos that your name is Rune. Because there's been a common misreading of my work, particularly my first book, The Spell of the Sensuous, Perception and Language in a More Than Human World. In that book, one of the arguments threaded through that book that was quite new and strange at the time was to suggest that formal writing systems themselves are a key factor in the estrangement of our bodily senses from the earthly sensuous. And I show this in all sorts of various ways. But people reading the book not carefully and with their own ready propensity for just some sort of black and white thinking said, yes, Abrams' book, that's the one where he has this derogatory stance toward the written word, or he demonizes the alphabet. And perhaps I should back up for a moment and just say, formal writing systems do this in very different ways. And the alphabet is very particular, but other more iconographic writing systems, like the ideographic writing script of China, or of course the hieroglyphic scripts of Egypt or of the Mayan Mesoamerica culture. These are scripts where in various written shapes and characters are derived from stylized images or drawings of mountain, moonrise, rain, tree, interspersed with human implements, faces, houses. And so the reader reading such a more iconographic script, pictorially derived script, is continually reminded of language's link to that wider than human landscape, because you're still coming upon stylized images of felines, of frogs and toads, of serpents and snakes. So as you're reading, your organism is reminded that language remains linked to a whole expressive landscape that is surrounding you. It's as if, yes, with a formal writing system, human language begins to turn in on itself and close one into a kind of the house of human language, but there are still these windows wherein you can look out through the letters and see serpents slithering off through the grass and see a deer leaping, a fox, a hawk swooping low, because it's right there in the letters themselves, in the calligraphy. This is very different from an alphabet originating in the ancient Near East. The alphabet, or the Aleph Beit, as we might speak of its original form, where each letter in the alphabet no longer images anything in the surrounding sensuous world, but rather you see the letter A and it points you toward your own mouth, making a sound. Ah, you see the letter B, you go B. You see the letter C, you go K. That is, the letters no longer function as windows, but rather as mirrors reflecting the human face back upon itself. I see the letter D and I go duh. So the letters just point me back toward my own face. And with this innovation, human language really closes in on itself. And the human mind starts to feel itself as a self-enclosed interior. But wait, and still, I need to complicate that and say, even when we're looking at the alphabet, at the earliest alphabets, which would be the Semitic Aleph Beits, ancient Hebrew writing, the Kassav Ivri, earliest Hebrew writing would be the earliest form of, or something close to the earliest form of the alphabet that has now come down to us as the Roman alphabet. But even there, you do find that many of the letters are images from the surrounding world. For instance, the letter A. The letter A was not, for one thing, it's not a vowel. It's a consonant. It's a glottal stop. It's the opening of the throat before all speech. And it was written as, well, not quite as our letter A, like this. It was upside down, like that. Aleph means ox. And the Aleph, the written letter, was an ox's head with two horns, was the head of an oxen.
Yeah.
The second letter, Beit. Beit means house. And our letter B was not written standing up as we have it, but was lying on its side. It was, if I have a pen here, I can just draw a picture. It was on its side like an adobe house with a door in the middle. something like that.
But yeah.
It got turned on its side and became the letter B. These letters got turned upside down or turned on their side because the direction of writing shifted. Instead of writing from right to left, as the Semites, as the Hebrews did, the Greeks started writing from left to right, and many of the letters got turned on their side or got turned upside down. The letter M, or originally Mem,
water.
It's water, Maim, water.
Mm.
And it was a picture of waves, our letter M with its two peaks. So even there was this opening onto the wider landscape. But once the letters came to refer just to sounds made by the human mouth, and of course they were carried across the Mediterranean by the Phoenicians and brought to Greece, and the Greeks didn't understand the name Aleph. They didn't know that meant ox. They didn't understand Beit as meaning house, or Mem as meaning water. They took these on. They said Aleph, let's call it Alpha. Beit, we'll call it Beta. Gamma, Delta. We'll just make these the names of these letters, which refer to these sounds that we will then make. So now the whole more than human world begins to fall out of the semiotic entirely. And it just becomes a closed loop between the human face looking at a letter which refers it back to a sound to be made by the human mouth. And so with the alphabet in this long evolution of its characteristics, the Greek and then the Roman alphabet as it comes down to us today is basically a hall of mirrors, which closes the human sensorium in on itself, this sense that the human mind is a closed interior, closed off a wider world. This is all very much born of the alphabet.
Yeah. So the entropic Cartesian enclosure is basically born from, or it has some roots perhaps in that original abstraction in writing.
Oh, indeed. There's no question. I would say the ideal forms in Plato's rich philosophy, the pure form of horse, the pure form of tree, the pure form of a desk, those ideas that don't exist in the body's world, but exist in some heaven outside the body's world, outside all sensuous pen, those pure shapes, pure forms, are indeed nothing other than the letters, Greek alphabet. Yeah. That's a much more complex argument to make, and I wouldn't try and make it here. But all of that being said, I think it's a way of pointing out that letters have powerful effects upon the human sensorium and upon our felt experience, upon what we hear, what we see. And which is to say that I was saying before, there's this misunderstanding of my work as that Abram, in his first book, castigates the alphabet. He gets down on the alphabet as having broken us away from magic and banished the gods and the spirits of place. And this could not be more wrong. It's a ludicrous misreading because, for one thing, I'm obviously a writer, and I'm writing books that actually aspire to be literature. There's a love of the written language in my work that I hope is evident to readers. I am not saying that writing is bad. On the contrary, I'm saying that the alphabet is magic.
Mm.
That the alphabet is an exceedingly powerful magic or animism. It is an animistic engagement. To read is to engage in a highly concentrated form of animism that is so concentrated, it effectively eclipses all of the other modes of participation or participation mystique in which we once engaged. I give you an example. I just with a magic marker, okay, I wrote down some letters on a page here, rather clumsily. Mm-hmm. Just very simply, with a black magic marker. And the page is pretty much white. What I want to do, I'm just going to flip this to show it to the camera, but only for a split second. So I want to do it very short so that you can, don't look at what it says. Look at the black shapes on the white page.
Okay.
Okay. Don't look at what it says. Just see it as black shapes on white page. Ready?
Yep.
Okay. Here we go. Okay. You able to do that?
No. It's impossible to not read it.
Yeah. As soon as you see the letters, you see what they say.
Yeah.
You see what they say. That is to say, they say, they speak.
Mm.
They speak very, very vivaciously to us as soon as we look at them. This is not that different from a Lakota elder who steps out from the village and is walking through the dense forest and comes upon a spider web that snags first on her face. And she pulls away from the web and then tries to catch sight of this spider, of this little arachnid who is now spiraling around trying to repair the web. But it's very hard to catch sight of because it's very small. As soon as she catches sight of it and her eyes focus on this little arachnid, she abruptly hears herself spoken to by the spider, addressed by the spider. Or around here, the Hopi man who steps out of the Pueblo and is walking through the desert comes upon a boulder covered in crinkly black and red lichens and focuses his eyes on one particular patch of gray lichen and abruptly hears the rock speaking to him, addressing him. This is animism.
Yeah.
We just do it with our own scratches and scripts. As soon as we look at the letters, we see what they say.
Yeah.
Our oral ancestors were doing it with spiders, with patches of lichen, with tracks of moose, with cloud shapes, bent twigs, trees, with pretty much everything.
Mm.
We now, literates, do it all the time and are caught up in this rich animistic participation with the words, the letters written on the page or now the screen. But I remember once, hiking in the Badlands here in North America, really weird, uncanny landscape filled with canyons inside canyons, a vast landscape that just sort of envelops you. And I got lost and I couldn't remember which way to get back to where my car was that I'd parked on the highway. And I'm climbing and climbing through these crevices and canyons and I'm coming up a slope onto a ridge and I suddenly see a sort of a rectilinear sign, the top of a sign, and I climb up a couple more steps and I see that it is indeed a metal sign. And I come up onto that ridgetop and the sign says, in letters, please deposit waste here. And it has an arrow pointing to a wastebasket. And as soon as I see what it says, I can hear almost with an audible pop, the whole of the landscape shrinking down to like a quarter of its size. And I look around and it's like, whoa, much more domesticated landscape. Oh, there's where my car must be, just beyond that next rise over there. But was that the canyon I'd spent all afternoon wandering? God, it looks so little now. Because the letters of a writing system, the alphabetic letters, have so much magic. They have so much mana. They soak up the mana from the whole of the landscape and concentrate it in themselves. Which makes sense. Follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, and totally. And that also, like that intensity of animacy in this tool also obviously explains why people would, you know, have a mystic treatise in which God is creating the world by moving the letters in between each other, or where or where the letters become single powerful symbols that are that bring something. To me, it seems almost that these kinds of ways of handling letters, that they I can't help thinking that there is a cultural resilience, that there's a cultural reaction, or perhaps guarding against that potential rupture in moving into the complete representation labeling way of language. That is somehow, you know, because traditional knowledge practitioners and knowledge keepers have extremely, I think, sharp understanding of, for instance, stuff like potential rupture. I can't help thinking that these ways of handling letters hold some of that wisdom of basically guarding us from the representational model or the contingencies in the, I'm not sure if that's the right word, or the potential problem in the representational way of understanding.
I think that's true. I think any use of any engagement with the letters as magic, rather than as a purely neutral tool for recording oral speech, for heaven's sakes, it's not neutral. It has brought such world-transforming changes to this world by the way it has deflected our senses from the vast body of the earthly sensuous in its polymorphic, perverse richness and polyphonic vocal expressiveness. It's basically the written word. It doesn't force us to disengage from the rest of nature, but it makes it possible.
Yeah.
Because it makes it possible, the vast majority of people will use it as a way to hide out from the difficult ambiguity of the real, from the danger and the felt ominous, uncanny weirdness of being out alone in the woods when you know there are things out and about that can eat you and ultimately will eat you, whether very big things or very small things like COVID-19 viruses. Or I better to stay encapsulated in my cocoon of words, talking and chattering about the world behind its back. But I think that any approach that recognizes that writing, and any particular form of writing, that the letters, even of the alphabet, are themselves an exceedingly potent magic, as I was just trying to show, that is to say that they have a much more than purely rational effect upon us when we engage them. I think that that is a very powerful way of resisting the purely representational use of language, which doubles the world into a set of objects on the one hand and representations of those objects on the other hand.
Awesome.
But to fold them entirely together, to bring them back together, yields a world of things that are not objects, but that are resonant, evocative powers that speak, that have their own pulse, their own rhythm, each its own rhythm and style and way of dancing into the present moment. Yeah. And yes, each speaks in its own way. Because the letters of an alphabet are still just a part of the world, and they do dance. And great authors, I mean, great authors are wielding the letters in such a way as to make magic, that is, in such a way as to open our awareness, open our imagination back onto that whole more than human polyphony of voices. And so the question is, can we use the this new technology in service to the full-blooded magic of the reason and its wonder? And anyone like Tolstoy is doing that. Wendell Berry is doing that. My sister Terry Tempest Williams is doing that. Annie Dillard does that with her writing. Rob McFarlane, beautiful writer, wielding the tools of writing, not to close the human mind further in on itself, but to open it back onto a speaking, intelligent, vivacious world of powers.
Thank you. I think you are beautifully expressing what I started by talking about. Then how can we work with this to move back in that direction?
Well, if I could touch in on one more thread in relation to that question, because there's so much. I mean, there's so darn much to be said here, but we can leave it for another conversation. But I did want to be sure to say that. And maybe you can just edit out this little interchange by asking if we needed to stop. It seems to me, Rune, that one of the most powerful strategies we can avail ourselves of now is the practice of replenishing oral culture. Rejuvenating oral culture, rejuvenating the culture of face-to-face and face-to-place storytelling, finding the stories that live in our locale, and that, yeah, we can write them down, but maybe that encounter with the bear last week, I'm not going to write it down because I don't want it to travel outside this bioregion. I want it to live here, and I want to tell this story there where it happened, of that encounter with the bear. And I'm going to gather people for the telling out in the land in that place. And we're going to give that place a name, or rather ask it, what is the most appropriate name for this magic that happened here? And we gather in the right time of year there, where the salmon come streaming back up the river every year. We're going to gather once a year in the right season and tell some of the salmon stories. And maybe we've got a dance we do as well, and some salmon that we put on to honor the replenishment of salmon, of this power that comes back and visits us.
Exactly, yeah. No, I've been thinking very much And I've been thinking about how to get specific in exactly that what you're talking about there. And some of these Australian Indigenous peoples, they're talking about how to basically move that act of knowing towards an imminent mode, where like Tyson Yunkaporta, I'm quite inspired by, he's carving objects for each chapters in his books. So and these people, they're basically talking about concrete techniques for how to move knowledge into dance, into singing, into place, so that landscape that we inhabit becomes a memory palace inhabited by that knowledge. Then the word owl, I think, will stop being a post-it letter and start becoming an immanent nature of the owl, that we are in a call response linguistic song with.
That's it, brother. That's it. We need to, among other things, start telling stories again, but not just stories that are written down and not just reading to our kids from another storybook, but actually closing the book and improvising a story about the wild wind that is howling outside, or just what happens inside that forest edge every full moon, or here in the city, when the traffic lights turn red whenever you're just pulling up to them and they turn red. Well, that's about the spirits, because the spirits hang out at the crossroads. We all know that. And they're really dazzled by the zip and snap of electricity. And they hang out here and they turn the light red whenever they see you coming. But improvising stories in relation to places, even spots, places, crossroads in the city, that is storying up the land again. We're not going to be able to restore this land without restorying it.
No.
Storying it up with tales that we don't write down so they don't travel to other lands. We tell the stories and we let them live in the land. We don't steal it from the land by putting it on the page or the screen. We let it live in the land, in that place, and in that way begin to return voice to this land that's always been speaking anyway. It really is about returning our ears, our ears to hear the speech of everything, which has been speaking all along. But that
Exactly. Yeah.
so key. And yeah, you mentioned the memory palace. It's so evident. And I think my first book, The Spell of the Sensuous, was the first to bring this out, that the outrageous animacy of the landscape for a traditionally oral or non-writing culture, a culture without a highly formalized system of writing, then just the necessity for remembrance, the necessity for memory in such a culture, all of the linguistically gathered knowledge by one's ancestors, the knowledge of how to get on in the land without destroying it, where to find particular animals at what season, which plants are good for healing which ailments, and which are good to eat and which are poisonous, and how to detoxify the poisonous parts to prepare them as medicines or as foods, and which fungi are good for bringing on visions, and which you better be real careful or you may lose your life. All of that knowledge lives and has to be stored in stories. I reckon maybe that's why they're called stories, because all of that is stored there. But the stories, how are the stories remembered? Well, that's just not been well understood until very recently. And I think The Spell of the Sensuous, my first book, was the first to bring out that the stories are remembered by being associated with particular places in the land where those stories happened, or where the events in those stories are believed to have happened. And when you come upon that cave mouth there in the distance, it triggers the memory of one or another story of how that cave came to be there, or you come upon this bend in the river or that cluster of boulders. And again, they trigger stories. They trigger memory of tales that happened there, that tell how that clump of rocks came to be there. And so as you're walking through the land, you're remembering all the time, or rather the land is remembering itself through you. And that this is the origin of what came to be called the memory palace of the great rhetoricians teaching the practice of the art of memory by erecting a sort of palace in your mind and then placing in each room of that palace a different image, a different topic. That's where our word topic comes from, is because topos means place. And the topic would be a place where I insert my friend's face because I want to talk about him there. And then let me, in this next room, I'll put a broom because I want to tell the encounter with that broom. And then over here, I'll imagine something else that I want to bring into the story at this point. And these were called memory palaces, these spaces of so many rooms where you would place the topic, you would place the theme of the next thing you wanted to speak of when you gave your lecture without looking at any notes. This was the art of memory. It derives entirely from the fact that our animal memory, there's always a visual counterpart to linguistic memory. And when it's not the book or the page or the screen, it's the landscape that was the visual counterpart for all our linguistic memories. The land, all that knowledge was held in stories, but the stories were held in the land itself.
Yeah.
And we lived inside. It's another way of saying we lived inside a speaking land in which every presence, every object, stone, gust of wind, branch, or track was animate and alive. Because you can't remember a story unless every presence in that story has its dynamism, has its vitality, its personality, its way of interacting with the other presences and interacting with you. So all of this is so caught up in what makes animism.
Yeah. I think it's really some awesome connections that we're making here. I also want to just connect to what you said a little bit before about allowing a story then to not rob it from that place. Like part of my background, I'm sort of religion, was that I had the privilege of learning from Afro-diasporic practitioners of Orisha religion. Now they have very particular ways of handling language where often there's like, they have a little bit of an ethos about not speaking too much about things. They talk a lot and they enjoy themselves and they flirt and have a good time and all these things that humans do. But there's some things that they don't talk about. And I think, like reflecting on it, I think that some of the things that they don't talk about is that they don't want that for instance, if there is a relation, say there is a relation between a human and an Orisha, then that relation can be conceptualized in many different ways. The Orisha can be a protective father, but it can also be an abusive rapist that takes you in possession, or it can be a child that the human is teaching how to behave to be a culturally appropriate Orisha in that place. Or it can be a marriage spouse in initiation. These are actually wildly contradictory roles that encapsulate different parts of that relation. But being silent about something like that allows the variety of that relation to be able to live. And Yeah, and I have specifically thought about this thing about that you mentioned with stories that belong in one place and perhaps not in other places. And how exactly do we regain that? Do we start pilgrimage routes where we encourage people to listen to their dreams? And listen to their experiences in these places and see what emerge, and then teach them very powerfully, I would think, to focus on the human knower and the relation rather than the detachment of Instagram. Like today we have a it seems to me that the screen world, amazingly connective as it is in some ways, has almost sidelined the human knower completely. So the knowledge keeper is almost gone because all the knowledge is always just a couple of search terms away. And so there's a quite serious shift that needs to be somehow encouraged if we are to move towards this landscape-based ways of knowing.
Yeah, and in the fact that any bit of knowledge I can just Google it and call it up on my screen, this is very painful because it's superseded. Even what I maybe you were able to get a taste of when you were young, I don't know, but wanting a piece of knowledge, heading to the library, pouring through the library cards in these file cabinets until you found, the right one, writing down what the letter number code was, and then taking it up with you to into the stacks of the library, first floor, second and a half floor, third and a half. Here's the right floor. Where's the right row? Okay, this is the right row. Go down the row. Oh, these seem like weirdly pertinent to the topic I'm looking for. I'm looking for a particular book, but whoa, look at this book. I didn't know this existed. Oh, and this one too. And I have to admit, I found many of my favorite books just in that way. But you were using your muscles, making your way through the terrain, through the land to get downtown to the library, up into the stacks, crawling through these stacks to find a particular book.
It's the hunt again.
It's the hunt, and it's the use of the muscles in bringing the information, giving it a context of muscle memory and feeling and ache, which is very different from this just everything sort of floats free of everything else kind of
And that knowledge is also place-based in a sense, in a sense.
in a sense. But I mean, libraries are powerful places for sure, and books are powerful places. And I again, I don't mean to be doing any kind of neat bifurcation of this good, this bad, saying writing is a powerful magic, and each form of writing, ideographic writing, a uniquely powerful magic. The writing of the Greek alphabet, weirdly different from the Hebrew, weirdly different from the Roman alphabet today. Each a unique and powerful form of magic. But they have a lot to answer for because they have made it possible for us two-leggeds to become so estranged from other animals, from the plants, from the winds and the water powers, and to be become so estranged from our own animality, from our own bodies. We now log online, and I get to have this conversation with you in which we're basically talking heads, but my body is sort of put out of play entirely. Feels good to offer it a little drink, but people watching are just encountering our heads, not our bodies. And that brings me to kind of something I want to say, if I can find a way of saying it that's not too awkward, but it's just that it's our body. It's this whole full-bodied, two-legged, creaturely, two-armed form that is my access to a tree, to the body of another animal, to the body of a stone, to the body of seaweed, a clump of seaweed, or a clump of sagebrush. It's the body that is our access to the stars, to the moon, to the mountain ridges, to the river, and the blessing of jumping in that river and just immersing myself. So it's more than anything else. I mean, if we want to speak of magic, or the most potent, magical, animistic ways of shape-shifting a culture with anything approaching the kind of rapidity that is called for now, go by way of the body.
Yeah.
Start identifying with your animal creaturely presence, that you are an animal. Whatever else you are really nifty, goofy, incredibly sly, very social, but prone to massive confusion creature, and hence an animal like all the others, like the ants and the hummingbees and the spiders and the humpback whales and the elephants and the sloths. Mm-hmm. We are creatures. We're animals. We're bodies of this earth. And so, for God's sakes, when we speak, whenever we're wielding this incredible magic we call language or verbal language, to try to not speak as a disembodied mind, talking to other disembodied minds. That is, don't use terms that have no felt sensuous bluster or rhythm or music to them, but that are so abstract and disembodied. I don't know what, you know, like the jargon that circulates through so many of our graduate schools and university campuses now.
For me, I'm still in an unlearning, I think, process from that, because I kind of did my PhD in this kind of ontological turn thinking, and at my PhD defense, I don't think anybody understood a word that was being said, there's a weird irony to the fact that some of the thinkers and scholars who are the most invested in thinking about relation are the most unrelational in their way of using language. But
I think that's a really important reality that needs to be noticed and named, that so many of those who are doing some of the richest, you know, leading edge thinking, it would seem, but they're still wielding their words in such abstruse, incredibly abstract ways that nobody, no animal can make head or tail of what's being said. You know, and then there are strange critters like our friend Bayo, who stages these raids on academe and steals their various forms of jargon and then goes back and weaves these jargony terms into strange poetry. Bio are the only people I know who can do that. But because even there, those words can disclose a bit of rhythm, a bit of texture. But by and large, when we are speaking academically, we are speaking as disembodied minds to other disembodied minds. And if there is any source of the massive ecological polycrisis, it is the fact that we are now so caught in our detached, abstracted minds and so cut off from our sensate animal flesh that we no longer feel what is happening to the river as it's being dammed up yet again, what's happening to the forest as yet another clear cut is coming through. What these droughts really mean to all the other animals here and these wildfires that come rolling like a storm across the land down here. It's like we're insulated. We've got our internet. We can just talk and talk about it.
And, but I would say that scholars like you yourself and Per Ingvar Haukeland that I met here in Norway are definitely showing a different way. Like when I met Haukeland, I was like, man, so he's a philosopher and a hunter at the same time. Like I already felt that I was a little bit weird because I'm a historian of religion and I actually went out and lived with religious people. Other historian of religions also do that, but I went to them to learn from them, and I actually know how to play drums and but a hunter and a philosopher at the same time. I think that there are huge amounts of scholars that are I think a lot of what is being done today is not producing a lot. It is not affecting the world a lot. But like, I think there are also positive beacons of hope somewhere.
There certainly are, and my craft is also that of a sleight of hand magician. That's what got me into all this, and is sort of my original license to be speaking about magic was from traveling as an itinerant sleight of hand magician through Southeast Asia, through Sri Lanka, through Indonesia, through Nepal, looking to meet the traditional magicians or medicine people who were practicing their magic, their craft. They're in various backwaters, village backwaters of those cultures, and seeing if I could approach them not outwardly as a researcher, but as a sleight of hand, as a magician in my own right. And in fact, I got in way over my head, and that's changed my life around entirely, but was invited into the homes of these exceedingly bizarre folk. And asked
that sounds to, like an incredible story.
And asked to trade magics with them and asked to participate in their ceremonies. And that's where all my work comes from this.
Wow.
But it's just to say, so there are those of us like yourself, like Per Ingvar, like myself, and no doubt many others, who are working on many fronts and don't just see ourselves living inside this strange, isolated zone of the human scholarly mind looking out at the world like spectators looking at a spectacle. But we are participant and wildly participant in that world and in affecting change within the world, in shape-shifting the world. That's the work. That really is the work. And that's the work of any scholar that's half awake, I think, as well. Because the tools that she uses are magical tools and always were. To pin
amazing.
One last thought on this. To try then to speak when one is in a classroom, when one is giving a lecture, or when one is hanging out with your friends over some beers or out in the land, to try to speak always as a full-bodied human creature and not as a disembodied mind, wielding words that don't speak to the bodies of the people you're conversing with, but rather just speak to their intellect. And so you might be arguing for the fact that the mind-body split is not really a split, and somehow these two really do come together. But in your way of arguing it, you're using words in such a way that everybody has to detach themselves from their senses to follow you, and they end up agreeing with you, but just as far cut off from their body and their senses as they were before. This is how we're perpetuating the ecological crisis steadily and steadily and steadily and steadily. Start speaking as animals, start speaking as full-bodied creatures who are actually part of the same world that the ants and the hawks inhabit and the bristlecone pines and the moon.
Preach, brother, preach.
Well, you know, just the importance of speaking with keen attention to the rhythm of one's words, to the texture and tonality of one's voice, to the taste of the words on your tongue, or the way they roll off your tongue. And I reckon that's what great poets do, is they call us back to the earthly rootedness of language. And they listen in for those, you know, soundful, musical nuances. Sometimes they even, if they don't find a word that just matches what they're trying to say, they coin one out of whole cloth. Do you know the work of the great English poet Gerard Manley Hopkins?
No.
He's a wonder in this regard. He became a Jesuit priest and threw out all his poetry, burned it actually, and then discovered that he couldn't breathe without continuing to write poetry. So he had to get a special dispensation from the brothers to continue to write. But this cat is so attuned to the sound spell of words that he becomes, as it were, the most animistic of poets in the English language. Is also one of the most deeply Christian poets. I give you one example. He's posted to Glasgow to work as a priest. And so while he's in Glasgow, Scotland, he's listening around in the Scots dialect local to that part of the land for words that really taste good on his tongue. And here's a poem he composes about a stream called Inversnaid while he's up there. He says, well, he's using the Scots dialect word for stream, which is burn. And he says, this darksome burn, horseback brown, his roll rock high road roaring down in coop and in comb, the fleece of his foam flutes and low to the lake falls home. A windpuff bonnet of fawn froth turns and twindles over the broth of a pool so pitch black, fell frowning, it rounds and rounds despair to drowning. Degged with dew, dappled with dew, are the groins of the braes that the brook treads through. Wiry heath packs, flitches of fern, and the bead bonny ash that sits o'er the burn. What would the world be, once bereft of wet and of wilderness? Let them be left, oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet. That's Hopkins.
Wow, man. Thank you very much.
But so that's word magic. That's word magic. That's just leaning into the potent efficacy of speech itself and oral discourse and the pleasure of sounding in a world that is itself speaking all the time. And that's maybe what I wanted to just end our conversation here with is just a sense that a suggestion that folks, if you want to begin speaking as a full-bodied human animal, one simple clue is just allow that everything else is speaking too. So the hum of the refrigerator in the next room, the gurgling of water in the pipes in this house, the wind gusting through the branches, that too is a voice. What does it convey to your body? Bird song, of course, a rich whole panoply of liquid voices, some of them raucous like the ravens overhead, the howls of coyotes, yes, but also the cricket rhythms as the warmth comes on. All these other voices, when you feel that everything is speaking, you know, everything is also listening. And so how does that affect your speaking and what you have to say? Notice how it shifts the way you speak when you're aware that there are all these other presences listening.
Totally.
That's the question.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. And thank you so much again for coming on here. It was an absolute joy to have the chance to chat with you live like this. And thanks for sharing all this wisdom. I really, really think some awesome points were made here. And yes, so thanks and hope to see you again sometime.
Yeah, all best to you, Rune, and all good magic for your project.
Thanks a lot.
It's a very bodacious project you're engaged in, Nordic Energy.
Yeah.
Keep going. Yeah. Keep going.
Thanks. Skønt vi er nødt til at komme nu, når kommer. Vil vi rejse op?